Marco, in your own time.
Okay.
Siento que el barco mío ha tropezado allá en el fondo con algo grande. Y nada sucede. Nada. Quietud. Olas.
We'll come back to those lines, but I wanted to begin with Spanish. I'm very glad Marco is here. Because it's my way, I suppose, of saying thank you to Spain and to the language, because for my 4 weeks in the Sierra de Aitana, 850 meters above sea level, everything was bound up in the landscape, naturally, but also in the language. All the teaching, all the announcements, all the translated elements of the ritual were translated into, well, were given in English and Spanish. Con acciones de amor y bondad purifico mi cuerpo. Of the 12 of us being ordained, 4 had come from Mexico. The translation was generally given in Castilian Spanish, but the responses came back in Mexicano. And it's on my bucket list now to get to the Triratna centers, possibly on yours as well, to get to the Triratna centers in Mexico City and Cuernavaca, to hear the precepts that way again, con acciones de amor y bondad, recited by the 4 remarkable men who were in Cojiloco with us, and by their Sangha sisters and brothers in Mexico as well. On the subject of language, the 12 of us being ordained came from 8 different countries. And on some nights in our multilingual pujas, we gave the 5 positive precepts in 9 different languages. Gaelgian a mask. De gnifra grovra glonan macharp. It did feel perhaps a little awkward at times, probably had an element of flag-waving about it to begin with on the first night. But when we got into it, English followed in rapid succession by Spanish, Dutch, Estonian, Scots, Gaelic, Hindi, Irish, Marathi and Turkish. It became, for me at least, not so much a celebration of our diversity, although that was there to begin with, but a little revelation of how superficial our precious group identities, our national identities, seem in the context of our shared striving for the Dharma. When you're in Cojiloco, you'd never think it, but I checked this on the map. You are 7 kilometres as the crow flies from the flesh pots of Benidorm. The mountains have very kindly interposed themselves so that it takes the best part of an hour to drive up to the retreat centre, and the last 22 minutes of that is on a road where the taxis won't go. So the place is worlds away from the beach and the all-day English breakfasts and the nightlife. And it's aptly named. Sangharakshita said that he came up with the name Cojiloco very soon after arriving there in March of 1986. Cojiloco means the hidden place, the esoteric abode, the abode of mystery, Bhante also called it. It's the upper end of a valley rising fairly steeply and enclosed on either side by great slabs of rock, sedimentary rocks that were turned on their side by earthquakes, 15 million years ago, to stand as great walls on either side of the slope, rising almost sheer, 150 metres above where the retreat centre now stands. It's not a landscape easily to be adapted to human habitation, although sterling efforts have been made by Triratna WBO in the last 30 years. Take one look and you realise that that valley, like any wild landscape, still expects you to do the adapting. I had decided to arrive in Cojiloco as a pilgrim, with all my worldly goods, all I needed for the next 4 weeks, on my back, walking for 4 hours over the mountains. So I arrived alone to hear a voice calling to me through the trees, "Is that Amon?" I'd never met Mahamati before, for it was he, but I've never had a warmer greeting anywhere than that welcome to the valley. This is a man of whom one is in awe, one can't help but being in awe, whose name means great wisdom. He's Sangharakshita's secretary and friend, and yet he greeted every one of us, I know, on our arrival in the valley as a friend of his, whether we were meeting him for the first time or not. Now, as I work these days with visualizing the Buddha in sadhana practice, as we call it, and when I struggle, understandably, I think, a bit with having an awareness of a personal connection with the Buddha, and with the idea that if I were in that awesome presence, the presence of the Buddha Shakyamuni, that he would be glad, be aware of me and be glad to see me there, as of course he would, if I struggle with that idea, with realizing that, I think remembering Mahamati and remembering that greeting from that pretty awesome presence, I think that will serve me, I think does serve me as an inspiration. As does the memory of that voice. Later in talks introducing the six element practice, say, with great wisdom and echoing, of course, the voice of Bhante, phrases like, "No higher teachings, only deeper understandings." I feel like framing that one and putting it on the wall, except that having heard it in that voice, I don't need to. It's there. It's there forever. So I arrived as a pilgrim. I've heard since, on what authority I'm not quite sure, that that may have been in line with Bhante's vision for the place originally, or in the early days, that it would be a place where certain order members would live in some kind of monastic, semi-monastic setting, practicing the Dharma and receive visitors, pilgrims. I'm not sure. But for better, I take comfort from that. I arrived as a pilgrim, but I have to say to anyone here who is in the future going to Guhyaloka for ordination, don't do as I did. Do as I say now. Come in the taxi and get picked up or walk up the rest of the way like everybody else, because it was inconsiderate of me. The people who run Guhyaloka and who are about to begin a 4-week retreat, it's a very tense day for them. And the last thing they need is to have somebody out there they know not where, who is of a certain age, may fall over, and they may have to send Spanish Mountain Rescue out to look for him after dark. So, alas, I was the first and the last to arrive for his Guhyaloka ordination retreat in that eccentric fashion. For myself, I don't regret it. It was wonderful. Come over the ridge and see the valley spread out before me. I'd been there once before on solitary retreat at the beginning of last year. And the return was, as you can imagine, a very, very emotional occasion. Now, I never approached, or tried not to approach, the ordination process as a struggle. I tried at least to see it not as a test. Felt I'd wasted enough of my life's energy trying to be the best in the class, trying to do well, and generally trying to show off. Ordination training was not going to be another exam course, another audition, another scramble for audience ratings or whatever. At least that was the plan. But inevitably, in retrospect, one did arrive for the ordination retreat, with something of the attitude that this was one last hill to climb, or the last stage to be negotiated before the summit. Not a bit of it, actually. This was welcome to your ordination retreat. You've done the work. This is what more, I paraphrase, but this is more or less what Paramabandhu, who led the retreat, and Mahamati were saying to us. You've done the work, you will be ordained. And Paramabandhu actually told us, the first injunction he gave us was, relax, which was the last thing we were expecting to hear, I think. The effect was dramatic. I think we all felt it. With three weeks or more to go to ordination, we were already being invited to think of ourselves as virtually members of the order. And in that place, listening to those men, we were able to imagine that, or at least to begin to imagine what being in the order might mean. Now, I say begin to imagine, it might seem strange after years in the ordination process, years after having applied for membership of the order, you would think one would have had a fairly good idea. Of course, one had thought about what one would look like in a kesa, metaphorically at least, or maybe once in a while literally. But for me at least, the way into Buddhism and the path to ordination has always been a matter of thinking ahead and constantly realizing in retrospect that one had got it hopelessly wrong. To begin with, I think I imagined I was going to be a great mystic, a superb meditator, achieving great things down there. And then I discovered the phrase, the Bodhisattva ideal, and while still determined to pursue the path, had to change all my ideas about what that path was and where it might lead, still studiously ignoring the idea of Sangha, no matter how much my friend Sangha Shura went on about it. Yuck, you know, touchy-feely other people. Not my idea of the spiritual life then. Then, only after a couple of visits to Padmaloka, was I finally shamed into darkening the door of WBO Leeson Street, as it was then, and finally, ultimately, arriving here for morning meditation, what, 8 years ago, I think. So I had to make room for Sangha, in the sense of companionship on the path, at least. Another change, of course, came when I had decided that the ordination course looked interesting. I think that's what I thought about it when I started. And finally, after having started the ordination course, I've actually been embarked on it, finally discovering a little bit about what the order was about. All the time, boldly going forward in the belief that I knew where I was heading, and all along, really not having a clue. I don't feel entirely bad about that. There is something of that, I think, in everyone's encounter with the spiritual life, or in a lot of people's encounter with the spiritual life. In Guhyaloka, this time, I read again Banti's lecture, The Path of Regular Steps and the Path of Irregular Steps. For a long time, mine had been the path of irregular steps, constantly having to revise my understanding of the Dharma. My so-called understanding, of course, whatever it was that drew me to the Dharma in the first place. And that is a great mystery, a great, great mystery. A big question that I could and should spend a great deal of time on. Once drawn, I proceeded in the only way that was open to me, to give me my due. The only way open to me was by meditation, but mainly by study. The conditions that prevailed meant that was the way I went. That was the way open to me. And at least it was a way. At least it held my attention. However, as Bhante so forcefully puts it in that lecture, if we think our study has brought us to an understanding of Buddhism, and I quote, quite literally, we do not understand Buddhism at all. It is not that we have a limited or partial grasp of Buddhism. The position is that if we think we understand Buddhism, we do not understand it at all. If we 12 men who sat listening to Paramabandhu on that morning 5 weeks ago were so deeply moved to hear him say, you will be ordained, it was, I think, because of the implicit assurance that we'd come to some degree. We had somehow advanced at least a little from that position of complete non-understanding. We'd undertaken the ordination training that is the order's way of setting us on the path of regular steps from ethical living beyond study and philosophy through meditation to wisdom, conscious of the incompleteness of our understanding, keeping the balance expressed in Goethe's great dictum, to have fathomed all that can be fathomed and quietly to revere the unfathomable. Fulfilling Bhante's great vision for lives lived according to the Buddha's teaching in this world, in this place, at this time. I'm not going to say too much about the ritual of Guhyaloka ordinations, although they are the big thing in my memory. I'm sorry about that in a way, but I can't really apologize for it. Because it's for the sake of anyone who's going to be ordained there. I don't want to take from the mystery of it. But if you've seen, I can give this much away, if you've seen the photographs, you'll know that we wore blue robes, long, long blue robes, not just for meditation and puja, but for meals, talks and other meetings. There was a lot of giggling when we put them on for the first time. When we tried them on, we were dressing up. I made the comparison already that we were, you could imagine us like little boys in a Thai monastery, you know, at the age of 8, being dressed up as monks for the first time. But there was much more seriousness in the robing ceremony that followed. And for me, the memory of the, in that robing ceremony, the memory of the surplice and soutane I wore as a 7-year-old altar boy. And I'm glad to say the sense of the sacred that endured through my teenage transition to atheism and which has never really left me since the age of 7. Through the 4 weeks, we still had an element of that little boy's dressing up as monks lightness, and we were the better for it. Lila, a little reflection of the playfulness of the Buddha as we lifted our skirts clear of the puddles on rainy days, along with a deep sense, as well as the lightness, as well as the playfulness, the deep sense in parallel with it, of following in the long line of those who have put on a robe of rags or a more formal garment in order to follow the teacher. And the balance of lightness and solemnity was beautifully maintained by Paramabandhu from beginning to end. I've said already, promised in Kavan, that I wouldn't tell any of his jokes in case he wants to use them again. But I can show you, if you like, the photograph taken in the moment after he placed the kesa around my neck. When the kesa touches the back of your neck is the moment, apparently, when you become an order member. I'm still kneeling with my head bowed, looking very solemn indeed, and feeling very, very solemn. And he's grinning from ear to ear, ready to meet my gaze as soon as I lift my head, with an expression of joy, which I became very familiar with, which I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with, an expression of joy that sums up his love of the order and the Dharma which he served and serves and has served for so long. But I'm jumping ahead. Of the 12 of us, 4, I think, were accompanied on the retreat by their private preceptors, the men, as you've heard, who had overseen their progress through the process leading to their invitation to be ordained. For the rest of us, our private preceptors arrived after 2.5 weeks, so 9 days before the end. We knew from the day before that they were further down the valley on the Thursday night, being eaten alive by mosquitoes, as I recall. But we deliberately weren't told exactly when on Friday they would make their appearance. Mystery. I think Paramabandhu very careful all the time to stop us leaping ahead, to have us live with what was happening now, not planning to tomorrow's exciting events and the arrival of the preceptors. Of course was an exciting event after 2.5 weeks. talking to Padre Shura afterwards, I compared that excitement, and he did not disagree. I compared it with one's vivid memory of being in love and waiting for the doorbell to ring. That one. It's not an exaggeration. You couldn't be in a higher degree of anticipation, no matter what the circumstances. Because in the 3 weeks since we had last seen these men, our preceptors, the magnitude of what they had done for us, the strength of the bond we had forged with them, had been brought home to us as never before. I think you can understand that. Now, I could talk for a long time about Vajrasura, and I can't promise that I won't. But I will try to confine myself to what I had said in the shrine room the night before that afternoon when the preceptors joined us, when each of them was rejoiced in, introduced, as it were, in advance of their arrival in our midst. And this is what I said, as far as I can reconstruct it from my notes and the ad-libbing I did inevitably on the night. In our Dublin Sangha, we're very proud of the team that runs our centre. I'd like to pay tribute in particular to the care they take to foster harmony among us. Harmony in the order. I mean, the talks we received, the teachings we received, were not by any means higher teachings entirely. They weren't explorations of subtle matters of Dharma, probings of areas of mystical exploration. There was a strong, strong element of practical advice. You are going to live in this order. You are going to make this order work better than ever. You're going to make it more than it is. And these are your responsibilities. And these are the dangers to look out for. So harmony in the order and a strong sense of the things that can go wrong and do go wrong. Very frankly, sort of sometimes shockingly frankly, dealt with. So I felt moved on the night introducing Vajrasura in advance to emphasise this point about the harmony we have in our Dublin Centre. It is not meant to be, it is not to be taken for granted for a moment. As manager, men's mitra convener and teacher, I said, while also fulfilling other duties in the order at large, Vajrasura certainly earns his share of the credit for all that doesn't go wrong in Dublin Centre in that respect. He's a very capable man, I said, not easily thrown into confusion. However, I succeeded in reducing him to total confusion one afternoon this year by asking him to be my private preceptor. He'd been ordained for just over 10 years and nobody had asked him before. I thought at first, I'm always sure I've said the wrong thing, and I thought I'd got it hopelessly wrong yet again. But when he stopped choking on his lunch and managed to splutter out a reply, I soon realised that he'd been overcome by surprise, yes, but also by a great joy, a joy which he expressed more eloquently than he probably realises, a joy at being afforded a new way of serving the Dharma and the order. Service to the Dharma was again this great theme of the retreat. Serve rather than practice was what we were told. Serve being a word. Practice somehow implying a return. Practice makes perfect. You practice, you get something back. It was strongly suggested to us, don't practice. Serve. Do the work that way. Vajrasura, I went on, is a scientist by education and a highly intelligent man. It was, I think, the intelligence that drew me to him in the first place, an intellectual command that can draw you not to an intellectual conclusion, but to the delight he wants to share in, say, Subhuti's exposition of the Abhidharma, or the more difficult bits of Bhante's survey. I'm grateful to him for the intelligence and the delight which he so generously shares, for the harmony we enjoy, for his share in bringing that about, but perhaps most of all for his constantly shoring up my confidence, which he very thoughtfully did from the moment he first became involved as Mitra Convener with my progress in this direction. Before I spoke on that evening, I'll finish now this bit. I'll finish now. Before I spoke that evening, my good friend, who's now Kuladipa Kenny from Cambridge, had rejoiced in another Irishman, his preceptor, Ratnagosha, and had described his appearance, his stature, and his age in the course of that rejoicing. So I told people that it would be easy to tell the two Irish preceptors apart. Mine would be the tall one with the open face, who looks young enough to be my son, but with whom they would see me conversing as with an older, wiser brother. And when I said that, of course, I didn't know how much older and wiser, because in the ensuing days, before and after the private ordination, the 12 being ordained would be for the most part in silence, except with their private preceptors. And we two shared a hut for the rest of the retreat and talked for hours and hours and hours, sharing life stories and everything that seemed relevant to the great enterprise in hand. A period of the most open communication. And to find a comparison, I find myself going back again to what people of my age used to call my courting days.
We can't tell.
Great maxim for life: deny nothing. About the private ordination itself, for the reasons I've given, I'm going to say very little. It's personal to everyone, and I don't want to impose my memories of it on anyone who, as preconceptions on anyone who's going to be ordained themselves at Guhyaloka or elsewhere. And I talk in terms of Guhyaloka, but anywhere you get ordained is your Guhyaloka. You invest that place. I know from talking to other people, you invest that place with all the mythic qualities that Guhyaloka holds for me. I'll confine myself for now, as far as the private ordination is concerned, to remembering me and Vajrasura together in a very small space, him giving me the vows and the name. He was, for that short time, at once the friend I was getting to know better and better, and also something greater, guardian of the great treasure that he was passing on to me. So there was this higher dimension which coexisted with the personal one in a way that was very, very difficult to take in. You can imagine me there concentrating very hard. So much was happening in such a short space of time. I encountered in that short time moments of deep and surprising emotion, coming from quarters couldn't possibly have foreseen, struggling to take it all in. And as I walked away back to the shrine room, under the light of the full moon on the 24th of September 2018, trying really hard to hold in awareness the sense that everything in my life had been leading to that moment. And I can't say that I held it in awareness very successfully. It was just too much. Just too much. And as I thank Vajrasura for that and for everything, I actually have to include, too briefly, everyone here, all the women and men who have got me here. If I start naming names, I'm going to name some names, but I'm going to confine myself to very few, because I am sure to leave out the most important one. And perhaps when I walk out of here, I will have left out the most important one, and I ask to be forgiven in advance. Everyone here, and indeed in Padmaloka and elsewhere, who has got me here over the past 8 or 9 years. So I'll confine myself in alphabetical order to my prospective Kalyana Mitras, Dayananda and Maitrikaya, my Kula brothers, Declan, Kevin, and Vrijamuni. To them, I add my brothers in the chapter that I joined this morning. And I owe a particular debt of gratitude, one that I can never, never emphasize enough, to the women and men I sit with here at this center Monday Monday to Friday. And as I say to all of you, it occurred to me after I came in, as I was sitting down this evening, that I was ungraciously surprised, repeatedly surprised by the kindness and the warmth shown to me. And it actually reflects badly, it reflects badly on my attitude to people that I allow myself. After all this time, I'm still surprised by your kindness, by the kindness of Lorraine when she came in, kindness of Julie when she crossed over in front of me. I'm naming names now, so I'll stop. On the other hand, if being surprised means I haven't given you enough credit for your kindness to date, at least it means I don't take you for granted. And it's probably better to, certainly more pleasant to be continually surprised than to take you for granted. So forgive me and thank you again. Thank you. I hope you know that the love is returned and the help and encouragement you've given me will be returned, I hope, if and when it's needed. I hope it's not, but I hope for your sake that it's not. But it will be given, willingly and gladly and joyfully if ever I can. It took me a long time to begin to learn about the role of friendship in the spiritual life, the kind of friendship I've been talking about. At Guhyaloka, I was still learning. I learned from the sympathy I received when I was ill in the first 9 or 10 days there, and worried. I was worried then that I might have to leave the retreat. I learned later more about friendship from the man who had been worried about reconciling his family commitments with his order membership, worried in a way that no longer worries me, I'm glad to say. On that evening, before his and my private ordinations, he came to me with tears in his eyes, put his arms around me and whispered, "Marie and Jeannette are with us. Marie, my wife, Jeannette, his wife." I wanted to assure him that after tonight, there would be more than enough of the two of us to go around, but there wasn't time and I couldn't find the words. I learned also on that and the succeeding night from watching 10 more men walk to their private ordinations after Kenny and myself, Kuladipa and myself. We were ordained in descending order of natural seniority, not spiritual seniority. In other words, the old guys were got out of the way. So I had the great, great benefit of reliving my own progress down to the private ordination and return from it, and reliving the minutes, the precious minutes spent there with Vajrasura as I imagined one after another my brothers following the same path, going through the same ceremony, thinking, now he's getting the name, now he's coming back, now he's walking back in the rain. Sadly, they didn't get moonlight, clear nights of moonlight for the succeeding two nights while the ordinations were continuing. We had hours on those nights of sitting in silence, practicing metta. It was the most intense experience of metta I've ever felt. The hours, they were very long sessions. The legs were very, very sore. But they went by in a flash. They really did. The legs were the only measure of the time that had passed. In that metta, I'm always very careful not to claim, as Vajrasura knows, not to claim too much. I think beware, wary of claiming too much for the experiences I have in this line. But in that metta, through the retreat, and especially on that night, I could at least begin to envision the breakdown of ego identity, the going beyond one's idea of oneself. That was a major theme of the retreat, which is a major theme of ordination retreats, spiritual death followed by spiritual rebirth, both enacted in the ordination ceremonies, in the private and public ordination ceremonies respectively. I have more work to do in that respect, so you'll have to wait maybe a lifetime or two to hear me expound on the great reality that opens up once we go beyond the poor little worlds we construct to fit our ego identities. But in the valley, in those conditions, it was easy for the imagination to soar. Living under a rock the size of a city block, a big city skyscraper block, it was that much easier to surrender oneself to the vastness of what one was engaged in, the vastness of the Dharma, and to accept the smallness of our own measure of things, of our poor little egos. Struggling for a few days with a new name, and I did struggle, as Vajrasura knows, struggling with not being able to hang your identity on the convenient little peg of the old name. Amen, that was handy. But there was one afternoon I went for a nap, woke up, and literally could not. This was a private ordination on the Monday. This was the Wednesday afternoon. I woke up, said, "No, time to practice the new name again," calling myself by the new name. Nothing. Wouldn't come. They very thoughtfully hand you an envelope with the name on a card inside, and I did have to look at it. There's a strong rear guard action being mounted by Mr. Ego. It's very, very, and the beauty of ordination, of retreat conditions, of course, is that you can watch that happening. You can see how cunning that little fellow is at protecting himself. Well, not very subtly in this case, you know. He just kept saying, "No, no, 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 Dayasagra, no, no, stop that nonsense." So struggling for days with the new name, it was that much easier. Being aware of, becoming aware of what was going on, it was that much easier to see the wonder in moments of revelation that might otherwise pass unnoticed. And I'm going to finish with one of the moments of revelation, the main one that I'm dwelling on these days. One evening in puja, I was given a canto to read from The Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava, with the line, "Not falling into the errors of excitement or passivity." Not falling into the errors of excitement or passivity. The line doesn't really matter. Why it should have struck me so forcibly, I've thought a lot about, but for the purposes of what I'm saying now, we needn't go into it. The point is that in reflecting on it, I had an unfamiliar sense of something shifting. Something shifting deep below the surface. Things starting to fit together in a way differently to the way they had fitted together before. A couple of days later, I was looking for a verse to write on a card for someone, and I came across those lines of Juan Ramon Jimenez that we heard Marco read earlier. In the translation by the American poet Robert Bly, the whole poem reads, "I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing. And nothing happens. Nothing. Silence. Waves. Nothing happens. Or has everything happened? And are we standing now quietly in the new life?" Now those lines, which for now seem to me to reach as deeply as I can go for the moment, as deeply as I can go for now, into what's happened to me in the last few weeks. I read them while Vajrasura was still in Dublin, before he'd come out, when I still didn't know what my order name was going to be, when I still didn't know that from now on I would have to strive to be an ocean, and when I still also didn't know the title of that poem. I had it in a book, but the title wasn't given. Only in the past couple of days did I look up Bly's translation of Jimenez and discover that he called that poem Oceans. Thank you.